I'm Shamita Basu. You're listening to The Takeaway. By now, you've probably seen or heard about the viral video showing Christian Cooper, a black man, being threatened by a white woman, Amy Cooper, no relation, while he was birdwatching in Central Park.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
In the video, Christian asks her to leash her dog in a popular birdwatching destination called The Ramble, where dogs are required to be leashed at all times. Instead of leashing her dog, Amy calls the police on him, falsely accusing him of threatening her life. The incident raises a lot of questions, including about who can safely engage with nature in certain spaces. Drew Lanham is a professor of wildlife ecology at Clemson University. He's been birdwatching since he was 5 or 6 years old.
Well, it was nature and nurture for me. It was growing up in rural South Carolina, Edgefield, South Carolina, on a family farm, and having birds really as constant companions and marveling over their flight.
As a black man, Drew has spent years navigating the overwhelmingly white space that is birdwatching. And a warning that this conversation contains strong language that some listeners may find offensive.
The best way to put it, it's one of the whitest hobbies that you can have. And I've navigated it most recently, I suppose, with lots of friends who may not share my skin color, but who share a passion for birds. And so there's this transcendent sort of nature of loving birds that's helped me to navigate pretty serious social issues. I think about those epic migratory journeys. I think about their ranges and what it takes to be a bird, to weigh no more than a handful of paper clips, to fly thousands of miles, to sing your songs uninhibited. There's something to admire in that. But then I'm pulled back into realities of unarmed people, black people being killed. And it makes me wonder if I'm safe in my backyard doing what I'm doing. And the most recent episode with Christian Cooper in Central Park took me back to almost exactly a year ago when I was in New York City, I believe, and talking at the American Museum of Natural History about inclusion, diversity, and conservation, and having a walk in the park. We were in a place where it wasn't a big deal, apparently, or it didn't seem, to see black men, three black men birding. Now, come full circle, and with all that's happening in the world, it makes the navigation tricky. The news stream tells me that there's another reality out there that I have to cope with. So I'm sort of constantly back and forth and back and forth.
Have you yourself had to confront racism while out birdwatching?
Yeah, I have. And it's funny, it's not something I really recognized, I think, until I was much older, probably in my late 20s, early 30s. I began to wonder where the others were that looked like me, who must love birds as much as I did. So I became aware of the potential for danger out there, that there were places, for example, in Western North Carolina, where there were encampments of racists who were literally targeting black people. It wasn't the direct contact, it was the possibility of it. And so I've always been keenly aware of maps, of ranges, of racists, of where they are, of Confederate flags, of places where people suddenly call their homeland as separatist, and that they should be there and no one else should be there. And so that was really one of my first realities, I think, in that quagmire that racism is, and it sort of pulls you down mentally, but directly, more recently, having an encounter with someone who considered the good old days the days of niggers picking cotton. Mm. And having this very odd, I won't even call a conversation, but this listening and sitting and hearing someone referring to me, to black people, as that was again sort of a grounding. It was this fall from flight, but as a black American, I think you sort of steel yourself. You learn to expect, unfortunately, these incidents. Some of them are microaggressions most people would not recognize. Others are macroaggressions. Like I said, mm-hmm. if I when I see Confederate flags, it gives me pause. When I see certain other flags, it gives me pause to go into places. So it's a daily thing.
You know, Drew, you speak with such joy and reverence about bird watching, and yet you also talk about the distracting thoughts, particularly because you are a Black man who does bird watching. I mean, does it distract at all from what you're setting out to do when you go out?
Yeah, in some ways. There are places that I won't go. I mean, again, I talk about ranges and range maps, and I have a range map just like birds have a range map. And I have my own sort of, rather than a field guide, I have a feel guide, and I feel my way forward. And feeling your way forward is a tough way to go sometimes when you want to follow wild and free things. If you're inhibited in some way, if you know there's a place where you shouldn't go, or if there are markers like those flags that tell you, you know what, you might not be welcome here. Or if there's a history, really, that's been passed down of a sundown town, or if there's something in the news that has alerted you to the potential for danger, or if there's a lingering look in a neighborhood when you're chasing some rarity and you know that maybe that neighborhood isn't so diverse and people would recognize you as being out of your place. You know, the Ahmaud Arbery, that story hit hard for all of us in many different ways, but I couldn't help but think about times that I've been in neighborhoods that weren't my neighborhood, walking around mostly with friends, but on occasion or two alone looking for some bird. And I'm sure I was being watched because I wasn't supposed to be there, or being stopped by the police who saw me in a place and said, well, you look like a suspect, and being detained on my own campus. Those are sort of these constant things, yes, that distract. We develop, I think, and when I say we, I mean Black folks, I think we develop this sixth and seventh sense that's adaptive, that helps you understand, you know, this is a place that you should be, this is a place that you shouldn't be, or maybe this is a place you can drive by and look but don't get out. You know, maybe this is a place that you go with a white friend. And sometimes that's the advice that I've given other friends. I've said, you know, if you're going to go in that neighborhood, why don't you call a white birder friend to go with you? And they can serve as a buffer or a guide, because Black people walking around with binoculars or spotting scopes might not be accepted so readily in some places.
Drew, you've written about the parallels you see between the experience of birds and marginalized communities. You've written about this in Audubon magazine. Can you explain what you mean by that?
It's part of my bird-brainedness to see my life through a bird's life, and to see that struggle that birds experience and all that they have to overcome. A single hooded warbler, for example, to have traveled from Central America to made some leap across the Gulf of Mexico in a nonstop flight, and then to reach the Gulf shores, and then to work its way through swamps and forests and woodlots over developed lands where it cannot land, to be in my presence. And it's made that epic journey. If everything goes right, it has not had to endure some of the things that humans have done, but more than likely it's had to dodge not only natural predators, but things like outdoor cats. It may have had to dodge buildings. It may have had to fly through skies that are lit up. And so the human equivalent of that, I think, is what we often face on a daily basis, that there are barriers that each of us, no matter what color, faces on a daily basis, things that we go through. No life is without trial, but there are these tribulations of success that we can experience. But then when there are other barriers that are put up, when you're already dealing with issues, and then out of nowhere comes this predatory strike of prejudice, then there you are. you're trying to make your way to someplace just as that bird is, but there's something that's come and that's interrupted you. It's interrupted your day. It's thrown you off your flight path, and suddenly you're misplaced. You're displaced. You're a bird that's out of habitat. You're out of your norm, and you've got to reset. And that reset takes energy. And on a daily basis, to have to spend your energy, not just being you, but wondering why somebody hates you for being you. When I was watching this hooded warbler the other day and was amazed at the song, the song that this bird was singing, and I'm looking at its plumage, this wonderful olive-backed, lemon-yellow-breasted bird with a yellow face that's encircled, the male's face's yellow face is encircled by this black hood. This bird was singing on territory, and I'm watching it and absorbing it, but had in my mind as I was watching it that this bird could wear its hood without trepidation, without profiling, without having to worry about someone killing it just because it's a hooded warbler. And I really thought that. I my mind went there. At the same time as I was loving this bird and relishing my time alone with it, there was nothing else in the world at that time. There was this other part of me that was thinking, huh, what would it be like to be a bird and have that actual freedom of no judgment, of no suspicion? That's my feather fascinated life, I guess you would say.
What is your favorite bird?
My favorite bird is the one with feathers.
I'm sure it's unfair to ask what your favorite one
well,
is.
Well, no, it's fun to think about. I have lists of birds that I love. Right now, probably if I were pressed, it'd probably be the loggerhead shrike, which is a songbird that's in rapid decline. But it's a songbird that has habits that some people don't like. It eats small mammals and songbirds, but it impales them on thorns because its feet are too weak.
Oh, wow.
But it is a songbird. And so it's involved in sort of this ecological code switching, which people of color spend a lot of time doing, sort of switching between one persona and the other.
That's right.
That's my favorite bird for right now, if I have to name one, but writ large, it's the one with feathers.
Drew, I want to ask you to explain that a little bit further, code switching from a bird's perspective and code switching from your human perspective. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, there's this personality that we all have, our base of who we are. It's your psychic clothes, your psychological vestments, as it were, that when you go out to a business meeting, you know, you're wearing a collared shirt, you're wearing certain things, and you have a certain comportment. Your behavior is at a certain level. Well, what's the first thing that most of us do when we get back home? We can't wait to get into our sweatpants and a t-shirt and kick off the shoes, and we kick up our feet, and we are not worried so much about proper comportment. That's a kind of code switching culturally.
That's like cultural code switching.
Yeah, cultural code switching, and which goes a little deeper in how we might speak or whether or not we use certain colloquialisms when we're out and when we get back home, or whether, you know, I decide to relax and maybe my voice gets a little more southern than it usually is, or, you know, it's those things that, and then we're all sort of chameleons in that way. For birds, that code switching goes not so much into who the bird is. I always tell my birder friends, don't be worried about misidentifying a bird because they know who they are.
I like that.
A loggerhead shrike does what it does. It is who it is as a bird, but the code switching comes in when we perceive the bird, when we make judgment calls on the bird because of behavior, just as it does with humans. So the old name for the loggerhead shrike is butcher bird, and they were seen as being injurious to other birds. You look at some of the old texts and they will talk about protecting most birds, but killing hawks, owls, and shrikes were considered raptorial, in that they would sometimes kill other songbirds. And so here's a bird that has a life as a songbird, that it lives, but humans place it in another category. And so that's a, to me, that's sort of this cultural code switching externally of expectation. I see so many birds sort of in these double-sided mirrors, and I see them for the wonderful ecological beings that they are. And I try to understand that as an observer and a scientist, to not judge their behavior, but then to study how we have defined these birds because of that behavior, that we've put them, that we've bracketed them into categories of acceptable and not acceptable, of a good bird and a bad bird. That's something that that interests me greatly, and I think it impacts how birds are conserved.
What can the bird watching community do to be more inclusive?
There's some great folks out there that are really trying to solve that problem, or at least address it. I don't want to lay all of the responsibility on the bird watching community, but I want to lay the onus on bird watchers as people who, many, care about birds, not just to count them or list them, but to conserve them. And to conserve means to care with some intensity, so that you save some for others. It's supposed to be a selfless act, and so there's love involved. And if there's love involved for a wild thing who desires and needs the same air, the same water, the same soil, this same healthy earth that hopefully we're striving for, then bird watchers can be on board for that. And part of that is social justice, and part of that is paying attention, taking the binoculars down and seeing around you and recognizing that things might be different, recognizing that you're in a monolith, and that if you're going to go forward, if we're going to go forward in a way to help protect the earth, to help protect birds wherever, in Central Park or Saskatchewan or South Carolina, that ultimately it comes down to us joining together in a way and recognizing the fates are tied together with birds, that birds have always been our guides, our sort of signatories for the environment. We have to pay attention, not just to the birds that we see through binoculars, but we have to pay attention to what's beyond those binoculars, to what's in the periphery. I'm always struck when we'll go into an impoverished area to see some rare bird, tick it off the list, and we're carrying optics that represent a large fraction of the per capita income, but we leave with only those birds on our list, but we've left nothing better for those communities behind. And so I would like to see the birding community, individuals and organizations, really be use this opportunity and all this conversation that we're having, Shamita, to be not just inclusive, not just count diversity, but to be intensely intentional about inclusion. To call out the wrong when you see it, to not just film it, to not just be a stander by, to not just be an observer, to not just say I'm sorry, to not just be mad about it, but to do something about it, to talk to your friends. For I think the big moves now really are, quite frankly, for white people to talk to white people and to say, we can't tolerate this. I think back to my parents in the civil rights movement, and I think about it. And the civil rights movement wasn't just about black rights. It was about everyone's rights. And I think now is the time for a new kind of movement and for feeling, thinking, knowing people to step forward in ways that they may not have before. And sometimes, maybe, to engage peacefully but forcefully, but then to disengage. I don't have any room in my life or my my social media pages for people who would excuse the kinds of behavior that we've just seen. I don't have that space in my head or my heart to carry along hate. That's what I would like in my world. I would like for people to see birds and be transcended through them, to understand that this world can be better for all of us, but we have to make moves, and we have to make those moves now.
Drew Lanham is an avid birdwatcher and a professor of wildlife ecology at Clemson University.